You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. After months of anticipation, Theresa May's government has finally fleshed out in detail their view of Britain's future relationship with the EU. But what would these proposals really look like in practice? Today we're joined by members of the IEA's International Trade and Competition Unit, who give their view of the Chequers' proposals and examine whether they would allow Britain to maximise on the opportunities of Brexit. They discuss the importance of regulatory autonomy, the topic of their new paper, and why remaining too closely wedded to EU institutions would hinder our ability to negotiate future trade deals and create a more competitive environment. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations. First of all, can you tell me exactly what is meant by regulatory autonomy and why it's so important?
The concept of regulatory autonomy is that each party can set its own regulations as it wishes. Politically, this is a part of the return of the capacity to make one's own laws to the UK. And the EU would also make its own regulations. And of course, this would be in goods and services for the UK and EU. So that allows, first, the return of legal independence, and then the UK to decide its own economic priorities and create a more competitive economy with less burdensome regulation. Of course, what we do not mean is a race to the bottom in regulation. We mean Parliament has oversight over regulation as it would over any law with the UK as an independent state, and can improve regulation. It can improve regulation from the perspective of consumer welfare, and it can make regulation less burdensome, in particular for SMEs. One of the major problems with the regulation that is coming out of the bureaucratic EU system is that it tends to be in the short-term interests of major corporates who can handle the regulatory burden through large and growing compliance departments, whereas SMEs increasingly cannot. And so that cuts a great deal of innovation, of future innovation from your economy, which is absolutely at the heart of economic growth for any developed country. So we will be able to deal with the deleterious effects of the EU system on economic growth.
What is your take on what's been proposed by the government in recent weeks?
Well, from a Brexit perspective and from a free trade perspective, it's very disappointing. The proposition is that the whole of the United Kingdom would commit by treaty to ongoing harmonisation with EU rules on goods. This, in the report, is called a common rulebook, but that's really a bit of a misnomer, a bit of spin, because it's not a bilateral agreed rulebook. It's the UK agreeing to keep up with whatever the EU decides in its regulations on goods. Interestingly, the same does not apply to services, where the report envisages striking different arrangements for services where it's in our interests to have regulatory flexibility, but it also acknowledges that this means implications for the current levels of access to each other's markets in services. Now, it's worth noting, by way of background scene setting to this, that the focus on goods really illustrates that this is driven by the situation with the Irish border, and the Chequers statement refers specifically to the fact that this proposal is intended to reflect the commitments made by the parties in the joint report in December. Now, we could certainly have a discussion about that and whether the joint report commitments in December really mean that we have to completely harmonise on everything, or whether, in fact, had the UK got on the front foot and laid out its interpretation of those commitments, namely alignment as simply maintaining a degree of commonality in terms of achieving objectives rather than complete line-by-line harmonisation, we might be in a very different place. But as it stands at the moment, it's very much envisaged that the only way to get a deal through with the EU is to commit to this common rulebook approach.
And so what has been proposed around tariffs and the customs union, and is it workable?
Two very good questions. What has been proposed? Well, this is the sort of third way that was briefed last week. It's really actually going back a step again to one of the limbs of the original new customs partnership. You'll recall we spoke about how the new customs partnership envisaged paying the common external tariff at the UK border, and then for goods that ended up on the UK market, you would claim a rebate on the difference if the UK was operating a lower tariff. That was widely criticised for various reasons, and the new version of it is rather that the UK will have tariff independence and will operate a UK tariff at UK borders unless it is known that goods are destined for the EU market, in which case you will pay the EU tariff on entry and the goods will then be tracked all the way to their ultimate destination where they enter the market. So the idea of this is that it takes away that uncertainty as to whether an importer will ever see the benefit of a lower UK tariff. And in theory, it means that the UK will have much better outward-looking leverage in terms of reducing our tariffs. Is it workable? Almost certainly not. I have spoken to various experts in customs systems and businesses in international trade, and the word used was unimplementable. Many of these businesses aren't particularly delighted about the prospect of filling in customs declarations for imports from the EU going forward, but it was indicated that they would potentially prefer that to navigating this extremely complex system that will have so many variables depending on whether you know what the destination of the goods is and whether you're able to actually track and evidence those goods' progress to their destination. It's also extremely questionable as to whether the EU would accept this from their side. When this proposition first surfaced a year ago, it was one of the alternatives in the customs position paper last summer. It was dismissed as magical thinking. It's possible that the EU will be warmer towards it this time around. That seems to be the indication from statements in the last few days. But whether that's just a sort of tactical move to keep this moving on and run down the clock until they can eventually just say, actually, this isn't going to work, you'll just have to stay in our customs union, that seems to me to be quite a high risk.
This is absolutely true. I think in political terms, we have already been told what this type of arrangement will mean. For a services-based economy like the UK, to not have goods regulation on the table in trade deals will deny us leverage. The US ambassador to London has already said a UK-US FTA is up in the air. We were told a fortnight ago by Sir Lockwood Smith, the Kiwi former trade minister and high commissioner, that with this type of arrangement, he was describing NCP as it was then, but fundamentally it also applies to this. You can forget global Britain. This is our whole trading agenda is currently off the table.
And what model would you propose?
We would recommend that as two independent sovereign territories with control over their own regulations and their own tariffs, the only real way of achieving an agreement between the UK and the EU would be a free trade agreement. But a free trade agreement starting from a point that actually most free trade agreements only are able to strive for in terms of regulatory coherence and lack of non-tariff barriers. So it could be the most deep and comprehensive free trade agreement that stops short of a single market that has yet been seen.
Are there any kind of precedents for the sort of mutual recognition that you would want to see?
There are, but not on this scale. New Zealand and Australia have a very comprehensive agreement for mutual recognition in goods and services. That's certainly an interesting precedent, which we explore in our paper. Otherwise, other free trade agreements tend to have incremental elements of mutual recognition. The most widespread form of mutual recognition is in conformity assessment, where you don't recognise the underlying regulations behind a product, but you recognise the exporting country has the ability to test and certify the compliance of the goods with the import destination's regulations and standards. That's a really useful feature because it cuts out a lot of delay and uncertainty from the trade process. But it does mean that you will have regulatory differences, so you might have to make two different kinds of product for two different markets. The way around that is to achieve mutual recognition of the underlying regulation itself. And that's where the biggest challenge lies. And there's, outside of the Australia-New Zealand agreement and, of course, the European internal market itself, there aren't masses of examples of that, but there are some, even that the EU itself has. It has a mutual recognition agreement with New Zealand for regulations in meat and animal products. It has mutual recognition in respect of automotive regulations in the free trade agreement with Canada. So there are precedents out there that we would need to be able to build upon and sort of knit together in a much more comprehensive basis. This is also all underpinned by WTO rules, which provide a foundation and in some ways discipline the extent to which a territory can refuse to recognise the regulations of another territory where those regulations meet all of its requirements, even if they are not identical line by line.
Radu?
So I think in the round, what we're recommending is that the way to fulfil the mandate of withdrawal is for both parties to have regulatory autonomy. And the UK then makes an open offer to the EU, and that's to begin is one of unilateral recognition of EU regulations for export from the EU to the UK. That will provide, firstly, our businesses with maximised competition from the EU, and it will provide institutional competition because, of course, sometimes the EU regulates well. Some EU regulations are perfectly fine, but the point there is very important. When EU regulations work, an autonomous UK regulatory system can use them. This is not total and immediate divergence. This is the capacity for the UK to diverge. The alternative to that is through the Common Rulebook proposal for the UK to have every EU regulation officially just for goods, and for a UK government to tie itself in advance and say, whatever regulation the EU comes up with, we will also have, is extremely dangerous, especially once there is no UK representation in EU institutions and the EU has no incentive to regulate in our interests. In fact, for corporate lobbies within the EU, there's a strong incentive to regulate against the UK industrial interest. James Dyson has already said this. Were he to invent, I think he said, a driverless car, there would be every reason for continental car lobbies to make that in some way illegal. And that's a profound danger for our economy.
Yeah, and there was that famous example a few years ago. He invented a new vacuum cleaner that was far superior to the rest. But then they changed the rules so that you were only allowed to test them in like dust-free environments or something ludicrous like that.
This appears to be already happening, yeah.
How much scope in the Chequers statement is there for divergence from EU regulations where necessary?
Well, the statement says that Parliament would have oversight of the incorporation of EU rules into the UK's legal order with the ability to choose not to do so, recognising that this would have consequences. And this has been used to try and sell the proposition as genuinely restoring back parliamentary sovereignty and control over our laws. In reality, it seems to me extremely unlikely that such divergence would ever be more than theoretical, given that the whole reasoning behind this approach is to avoid the need for any physical operations or border checks at the border. Therefore, we cannot have divergence from a common rulebook. It's hard to see how at some point in the future, suddenly we could diverge from the common rulebook without completely undermining the whole reason for having the common rulebook in the first place. So if you have complete harmonisation of all regulations so that you won't have to have border operations, you can't diverge in something without the EU saying, well, we'll have to bring back border operations to make sure that that thing you've diverged on, you're not sneaking non-compliant goods across the border. That's a very extreme approach, but the EU has taken a very rigid approach to how it would envisage a future border working. So I'm afraid to say that the idea of parliamentary oversight and future divergence is at best theoretical.
Many Eurosceptics are extremely worried about the Swiss model, which, as you know, has these things called guillotine clauses, which means huge penalties if they break even a single clause in their bilateral agreement with Brussels. Does it look like what's been proposed would allow for more freedom than this?
In many ways, this is worse than the Swiss deal. The way the guillotine in the Swiss arrangement works is that if either party terminates one of a whole range of agreements between them, all of those core agreements will automatically terminate. So there isn't cherry picking between the agreements. However, in the Swiss arrangement for mutual recognition of goods, it's much more flexible. And in fact, Switzerland has elected not to join EU regulations in certain sectors, most notably in chemicals, where Switzerland hasn't implemented the REACH regulation. So this is actually worse than the Swiss deal.
So, you know, what about regulations with respect to the broader economy, not just goods?
This is actually one of the most potentially damaging aspects of the Chequers proposition. It's this idea of a level playing field or a fair playing field, where it's not just the common rulebook of specific regulations and standards for goods that's at stake. The Chequers statement says that in respect of the wider sort of horizontal matters like environmental protection, consumer protection, employment law, competition law, state aid, the what's known as sort of flanking areas, we would also accept to maintain high standards, which that's fine. Most free trade agreements would include commitments to maintain high standards in those areas. The troubling part is where it says that the UK would commit not to fall below the current regulations that are in place. And that, I'm afraid, is a terrible hostage to fortune, because it would suggest to me that anything that the UK decided to do differently, that needn't necessarily be a lowering of standards. It might simply be a slightly different approach to take the edge off something that's particularly onerous or burdensome to trade or to business, will be automatically seen as falling below the current level, especially as the European Court of Justice is likely to have the ultimate say on the interpretation of what those current standards require. So this would be a real hostage to fortune and would really lock us in across the board in the wider economy, not just in specific regulations for goods.
And particularly in a position where we would then have also surrendered any input we had into that process.
Yes, exactly. And historically, areas like the social chapter have been areas where the UK government has had serious disagreements with the direction of travel that the EU takes on these areas. And I would add, there's likely to be further concessions made in these areas where things like intellectual property would also be brought in. And the current direction of travel in the EU on things like IP is particularly troubling if we were to be locked into that with no say.
So in some ways, it would almost have been better to have remained when it gets to that situation.
I mean, a lot of people are saying that this is worse than being a member. We would have less control than being an EU member.
Another troubling part of the Chequers statement is that while the statement says it would end free movement, giving the UK back control over how many people enter the country, that's immediately followed with include a mobility framework so that UK and EU citizens can continue to travel to each other's territories and apply for study and work. That's very, very broad phrasing, and I don't think it would take much of a cynic to say that that sounds like a method of replicating free movement under a new name later on. So it's another alarm bell in this statement.
Yeah, how much is really at stake, economically speaking, by having, you know, even fairly anti-competitive regulations, given what we would have to forfeit in order to get to that situation? Are the gains really all that great?
We're now in a scenario where, as MiFID II and GDPR over the last 18 months have demonstrated, EU regulation is becoming steadily more damaging to consumer welfare and more damaging to growth. So there's considerable urgency here. And what that does is it puts the innovative companies that are the most important part of future economic growth at a serious disadvantage to the large incumbents. The EU is also aggressively exporting this approach to third countries. So it's this direction of travel of regulation from the EU that means once we secure regulatory autonomy, the gains from our capacity to make pro-competitive regulation will grow. And the more we can regulate in a pro-competitive way, the more economic growth we will have. That's what's at stake domestically. Then we can extrapolate that through global trade, that liberalizing approach will unlock growth on a global scale. We need the opportunity to do it.
Thanks both so much for joining me.
For more podcasts, blogs, reports and films, go to our website, iea.org.uk.